Well, it's Senator Matt Canavan here. I haven't done a podcast for a long time, but I am locked down at the moment in Canberra, not with much else to do. So I've been playing around a bit and I learned some new tricks on the camera and the computer. So this is a podcast for those of you listening in audio, but it's also available in video form as well on rumble.com. It'll be going up there. A link will be on my Facebook page and Twitter. Go and get access to it there if you want to watch it in video format. I will use the screen a little bit, so you'll miss out a little bit by just listening to it through a podcast app, but it's not going to be that much different. So I hope you can hang around. I really will just go through a bit of the news of the week. There's a lot going on at the moment, of course. I particularly focus on coronavirus today, but I did want to pay my respects to the fallen American soldiers and the civilians in Afghanistan. A horrific act overnight, Australia time. Just tragic for all those people there. And we can only pray now and hope that there won't be any more fatalities as the evacuation continues. Fortunately for Australians, that process had ended. I hope all Australians have got to safety, although obviously the situation is very fluid at the moment. But of course, the other big story here in Canberra and around the country remains the coronavirus, with lockdowns, with people, about half our population, suffering under lockdowns. Perhaps the most severe police state outside of North Korea occurring here in Australia. Really, it has attracted the attention of the world this week. I think it's cut through as people have increasingly seen the suffering that is going on in many Australian cities. I have been against these lockdowns for about a month now. I just don't think they are right for people. They cause enormous amounts of mental health strain, pressures. We've seen a lot of small businesses go to the wall this week. And of course, they're being pushed by people who do not get a pay cut, who retreat back to their often quite palatial homes and aren't living through the suffering that many others are in small cramped apartments with kids. I myself don't mind lockdowns, really, when I'm home at least. I've got an acre block, I've got a backyard. I don't have a swimming pool, unfortunately, but I can, you know, still have my space and spend time with the family. Instead, at the moment, obviously, I'm locked down, stuck here in Canberra, and I'll get to the Queensland government in a second. I did get my vaccine this week. I am not one to put up the obligatory Instagram post because I don't really think it's news that I got the vaccine. Around a million other Australians did this week, and that's great news. But I don't think you should listen to me about if you're on the fence, if you're not sure about getting it or not, go and talk to your doctor. That's the person to talk to. I've, of course, done my own research, had a look at it, and felt comfortable getting it. That's probably not going to mean much, though. If you yourself have some concerns, go and look at it yourself. And I really get worried here about how we're moving to a world where we're failing to respect others, respect other Australians. I don't have any issue with people making a different decision about a medical procedure. I've always felt that most Australians, the vast majority of Australians, will probably get vaccinated because that's what we see with other vaccines that are approved. And we are already, we're not far off, 70% of Australians actually getting their first dose. And so you'd think most of those people will go through to get their second dose. So we'll get to that mythical, magical 70% target relatively soon, probably the next couple of months. And then we'll probably get beyond that as well as the rollout occurs. But I always respect those people who have a different opinion on these matters. That is perfectly fine. And what concerns me here is now this idea that we'd mandate vaccines or have some kind of vaccine passport. What I'd really like someone to answer a little more clearly is how exactly does someone else getting the vaccine improve the effectiveness of the vaccine I have? I've got the first dose. Once I get the two doses, how does someone else getting the vaccine make the medicine that I've taken more effective? Because isn't the medicine I've taken, shouldn't it just be effective? shouldn't it work? And if I've got the vaccine, I believe I've reduced my risk of the coronavirus. Now, it's not zero risk, I accept that. It's not a completely zero risk, but it has certainly, well, I hope I wouldn't have got it otherwise. I've got it because I think materially it has reduced the risk to me if I ever am to be infected by the coronavirus. Now, someone else, Fred getting it down the street, doesn't change that at all. Doesn't change that at all. Now, the only argument you've got, is that by Fred getting it, I'll be less likely to even get it in the first place because he's vaccinated as well. But as we're seeing around the world, that's not the case. We're seeing around the world that countries with high vaccination rates are actually experiencing just as much transmission, if not more, than what they did last year. That's certainly the case in Israel at the moment. And so therefore, if you're still getting the transmission even when you're vaccinated, what is the rationale exactly to require and mandate every last person to get a jab? There's not a very strong rationale for it. And we don't really know at this stage why countries with a high vaccination rate are experiencing so much transmission. But there's almost no debate that they are. That is the facts. That's what's happening in multiple countries, and we have to prepare ourselves for that here in Australia. But I did want to. The first thing I wanted to highlight from different sources I've been looking at this week is a guy called Dr. Robert Malone. Now, Dr. Robert Malone is one of the pioneers in developments of the mRNA type vaccines, and I got Pfizer, so I've got that this particular development in me. And Dr. Malone is very pro-vaccine. But he's also open-eyed, if you do follow him on Twitter or other sources, about the fact there can be risks to vaccines and not there is some things that you need to weigh up. And he's got a very interesting thread here, which he posted about a week ago, just explaining how perhaps maybe we are, why we are getting transmission in populations, even that have a significant amount of transmission and spread. As Dr. Robert Malone, I won't read all of these, so those of you listening will miss some of it, but as Dr. Malone explains here, the Delta variant does have a much higher transmissibility. We've all heard that, and he admits that, and he sees that. On the data he presents here, it's at least double the transmissibility of the Alpha strain, and it's very, very transmissible, equivalent to something like the chickenpox. He does say, and which is what I've seen as well, that the vaccines are about 50 to 60% effective in protecting from infection. They're higher in terms of reducing hospitalisation and severe illness, and that's why I got the vaccine. But they do reduce infection risk as well. That's true. But of course, then because they're not perfect on reducing infection risk, there are these things called breakthrough infections, which do occur in vaccinated people, and that means that you've still got quite a high risk. Even if you are vaccinated, of transmitting the virus. And that's consistent with what we're seeing in other countries. So the conclusion is that what's interesting, I think, Robert Malone has identified here is if you get it when you're vaccinated, are you actually more likely to spread it? Not because anything to do necessarily with the physiology of what's going on, but because if you're asymptomatic, because you're vaccinated, you're not getting the same sort of sickness that you would if you were vaccinated, is that actually meaning that you possibly could be more likely to spread it because you just simply keep going out in society? You don't understand that you either have coronavirus or are at risk of spreading coronavirus compared to someone who's not vaccinated and becomes symptomatic and might, of course, then, or hopefully, would stay home, not go to work, etc. I think it's a very interesting point. It's a very interesting point. It's a behavioural point, not an epidemiological or virological point. But as he said, it probably needs to be more measured here. And it might explain why we do have this transmission occurring, even if people are vaccinated. And again, this comes back to the point. We are on the precipice here of saying that we are going to make people have a vaccine to simply go out and go about their everyday business. This is not just about people working in hospitals. There are people who want people who are not vaccinated not to be able to. I really get worried here about how we're moving to a world where we're failing to respect others, respect other Australians. I don't have any issue with people making a different decision about a medical procedure. I've always felt that most Australians, the vast majority of Australians, will probably get vaccinated because that's what we see with other vaccines that are approved. And we are already, we're not far off, 70% of Australians actually getting their first dose. And so you'd think most of those people will go through to get their second dose. So we'll get to that mythical, magical 70% target relatively soon, probably the next couple of months. And then we'll probably get beyond that as well as the rollout occurs. But I do respect, I always respect those people. Those people who have a different opinion on these matters. That is perfectly fine. And what concerns me here is now this idea that we'd mandate vaccines or have some kind of vaccine passport. What I'd really like someone to answer a little more clearly is how exactly does someone else getting the vaccine improve the effectiveness of the vaccine I have? I've got the first dose. Once I get the two doses, how does someone else getting the vaccine make the medicine that I've taken more effective? Because isn't the medicine I've taken, shouldn't it just be effective? Shouldn't it work? And if I've got the vaccine, I believe I've reduced my risk of the coronavirus. Now, it's not zero risk, I accept that. It's not a completely zero risk. But it has certainly, well, I hope, I wouldn't have got it otherwise. I've got it because I think materially it has reduced the risk to me if I ever am to be infected by the coronavirus. Now, someone else, Fred getting it down the street, doesn't change that at all. Doesn't change that at all. Now, the only argument you've got is that by Fred getting it, I'll be less likely to even get it in the first place because he's vaccinated as well. But as we're seeing around the world, that's not the case. We're seeing around the world that countries with high vaccination rates are actually experiencing just as much transmission, if not more, than what they did last year. That's certainly the case in Israel at the moment. And so therefore, if you're still getting the transmission even when you're vaccinated, what is the rationale exactly to require and mandate every last person to get a jab? There's not a very strong rationale for it. And we don't really know at this stage why countries with a high vaccination rate are experiencing so much transmission. But there's almost no debate that they are. That is the facts. That's what's happening in multiple countries, and we have to prepare ourselves for that here in Australia. But the first thing I wanted to highlight from different sources I've been looking at this week is a guy called Dr. Robert Malone. Now, Dr. Robert Malone is one of the pioneers in developments of the mRNA type vaccines, and I got Pfizer, so I've got that this particular development in me, and Dr. Malone is very pro-vaccine, but he's also open-eyed, if you do follow him on Twitter or other sources, about the fact there can be risks to vaccines, and there is some things that you need to weigh up. And he's got a very interesting thread here, which he posted about a week ago, just explaining how perhaps maybe we are why we are getting transmission in populations, even that have a significant amount of transmission and spread. As Dr. Robert Malone, I won't read all of these, so those of you listening will miss some of it, but as Dr. Malone explains here, the Delta variant does have a much higher transmissibility. We've all heard that, and he admits that, and he sees that. On the data he presents here, it's at least double the transmissibility of the Alpha strain, and it's very, very transmissible, equivalent to something like the chickenpox. He does say, and which is what I've seen as well, that the vaccines are about 50 to 60% effective in protecting from infection. They're higher in terms of reducing hospitalisation and severe illness, and that's why I got the vaccine. But they do reduce infection risk as well. That's true. But of course, then because they're not perfect on reducing infection risk, there are these things called breakthrough infections, which do occur in vaccinated people, and that means that you've still got quite a high risk even if you are vaccinated, of transmitting the virus. And that's consistent with what we're seeing in other countries. So the conclusion is that what's interesting, I think, Robert Malone has identified here is if you get it when you're vaccinated, are you actually more likely to spread it? Not because anything to do necessarily with the physiology of what's going on, but because if you're asymptomatic, if because you're vaccinated, you're not getting the same sort of sickness that you would if you were vaccinated, is that actually meaning that you possibly could be more likely to spread it because you just simply keep going out in society? You don't understand that you either have coronavirus or at risk of spreading coronavirus compared to someone who's not vaccinated and becomes symptomatic and might, of course, then, or hopefully, would stay home, not go to work, etc. I think it's a very interesting point. It's a behavioural point, not an epidemiological or virological point. But as he said, it probably needs to be more measured here. And it might explain why we do have this transmission occurring, even if people are vaccinated. And again, this comes back to the point. We are on the precipice here of saying that we are going to make people have a vaccine to simply go out and go about their everyday business. This is not just about people working in hospitals. There are people who want people who are not vaccinated not to be able to go to a cafe, a restaurant, the football, even more, even just going to get food and groceries in some countries. We're seeing those liberties be restricted to unvaccinated people. That is a major, major restriction on people's liberties. And you'd want to have pretty good evidence that putting such a significant restriction on people is going to deliver less transmissibility and ultimately less severe illness or death. That might not happen if what Dr. Robert Malone is saying is right. So I don't think there is very strong evidence at all for having vaccine passports in this country. And I really worry about how divisive we're getting, having some kind of medical apartheid, where if you don't have the right papers or haven't made the right decisions about your own health, you will be put into some kind of COVID jail type arrangements in a permanent lockdown. That is not the right way to go about things. Now, I was talking to a friend this week about this, about how we can possibly fight back against vaccine passports. I'm against them. I don't think they're the right approach for a cohesive and harmonious society that we are here in Australia. But you do have to admit that they are probably the popular option out there. There's a few people in this place that are against the vaccine passports. George Christensen, my colleague, good mate, has been out there likewise, but there's probably not a majority of us here. I'm in my Senate office here at the moment at Parliament House. There's probably not a majority of us against vaccine passports. And there's not a majority of the population, as you see here in this article. Most workers support the implementation of some type of vaccine passports. Apparently, according to this survey, it's 77% in New South Wales support requiring, the way the question's worded here is allowing or providing for greater freedoms if you're fully vaccinated, so effectively the same thing. Now what does this mean? It seems to me that the 77% figure of people who support vaccine passports is probably pretty similar to the number of people at the moment who want to get the vaccine. So you understand if you're getting the vaccine, you'd like to get your life back on track and like to get out of lockdown and not have any restrictions. So I can understand that. I can understand that finding. And maybe that will grow as the vaccine continues to roll out. So we might even see more than 77% of people saying, yep, vaccine passports, vaccine mandates should be the right approach, should be what we do. Well, I mean, that is, of course, worrisome for people who don't want to see this come in. What can we do about it is the question. So my friend asked, well, what can we do about it? Can we oppose it? Can we campaign against it? Well, as I was thinking about this, there's not much then, if we don't have a majority, that we can do in Parliament, unfortunately. I'm opposed to it, and I'll continue speaking against it. I'll do everything I can in my platform, in the Senate, through these type of communications, I'll oppose it. But politics, and here in Parliament, it's a numbers game. It's a brutal numbers game. If you don't have the numbers, you're not going to get what you want done. And it doesn't look like the opponents of vaccine passports have the numbers. Democracy, you know, is the best of all, or the worst, sorry, the best of all the worst systems we've got for government. It's the worst of all systems, but it's the best of all. So we don't have much other alternative from a lawmaking perspective but democracy. So we just have to realise that we're probably not going to be able to oppose vaccine passports in the parliament itself. I don't know if that'll happen because it's majority rules here. It's a majority, you get a majority. If a majority wants the vaccine passports, they'll probably get them. Now, the only protections against that, of course, is if you have a Bill of Rights or a constitution which doesn't allow a tyranny of a majority to occur. Now, we don't have that here in Australia. And while there's some hope that our constitution would provide some limitations on what can occur, in this case, in terms of vaccine passports, it's probably hard to see whether or not that would occur. Now, are there an alternative, though? Is there an alternative to relying on Parliament to fight these things? I think there is. Because the way our society works is not just governed by what laws go through our Parliament. When we're talking about what a business is going to do here, whether a cafe is going to require you to show your papers, whether a restaurant will allow you to sit inside to eat if you don't have a green tick on your phone, that's a commercial decision. It's going to be a decision that's made through the market, not through the parliament. At least I think that's what's going to happen. I mean, I don't think we're going to end up in the France situation. I mean, I don't know if people have seen this little video here, but in France, you are seeing, because the government has mandated that you can't eat at a cafe or restaurant, in France you're seeing unvaccinated people there congregating, having picnics on the boulevard because they're not allowed to sit in the restaurant. It's a form of protest here, of course. I don't think we're going to end up in that situation here. There's not really a proposal for governments to mandate this restriction. What we're saying is we're going to let commercial businesses decide what they do, whether they're going to require a vaccine passport or not. So you've already seen some businesses say they'll require it of their workers. I don't think any businesses have yet said they're going to require it of their customers, but you can potentially see that coming down the track. But because the market's not the parliament, it's not a situation where the majority rules. There actually is hope here. There's some hope that we can make sure that vaccine passports do not become a common feature of the Australian marketplace. And the way to do that is simply to boycott those businesses that do that thing. Is to start a process where you or I and a bunch of others say, look, if you're a cafe, if you're, you know, the local coffee shop, and you say, okay, I'm going to require you to show me your medical papers before you can get a cappuccino, well, we can just say no, I'm not doing that. I won't do that, and I'll. That'll definitely be my view. I've got my first dose. I plan to obviously get my second dose. So I'll be able to, on my phone, I'll be able to, you know, get the app and presumably I get this green tick, and so I can walk freely in and out of everywhere. But I'm not going to show people my medical papers if I don't have to. I'm not going to do it. And that's what we need to do. We need to organise, just simply, a liberty boycott of any business that is doing this. Now, there will be, of course, some businesses we might not be able to do that to. They've got a monopoly. If Qantas and Virgin do it, I'm probably going to have to show it because I'll still have to get on a plane to come down here to work and all those things. So it might not be pure. But it doesn't have to be pure to have an impact. And it doesn't have to be a majority. Because let's say you're the cafe in the main street of a town and something like, if we've you know, 15-20% of people, because it's not just going to be the unvaccinated. There'll be some vaccinated people like myself who will join the cause. If we just get together and say, okay, we're not servicing that business, we'll go to the coffee shop down the road who's not doing it, and they lose 15-20% of their custom because of that policy, plus all the cost of having to check it every time, the hassle, all those things. If that's what happens, well, that coffee shop is not going to do that. Well, that's big. That's big. If you lose 15-20% of your revenue in a competitive game like a coffee shop, that's going to have a big impact. Because what's important in the market is not so much what the majority thinks. It is how passionate people are to decide on their business on a single issue. And we see that already, right? You see that in the market right now. You see company after company saying they've committed to net zero. They've committed to cut all their carbon emissions. Now, it's probably not that a majority of customers care. I doubt it. I doubt you'd have a majority of customers saying, look, if this airline is not committed to net zero emissions, I'm going to go to the other airline. Or if this supermarket chain is not committed to net zero emissions, if Woolworths commits to net zero emissions and Coles doesn't, I'll go to Woolworths. I don't think that's not the issue. That's majority of people don't make up their decide which shop they go to get their cereal based on a company's net zero emissions policy. But enough people do. It's a minority. It's the green people. The green people who are concerned about these things. They're probably maybe 10, 15, some areas they'd be 20 or 30% of people. They will possibly decide on that basis. And because they will make that decision based almost exclusively on that basis, all of the businesses you see will sign up to net zero. Because on the other side, even if it's as low as 70%, but a big majority of people will not decide where they shop based on the net zero emissions policy of the supermarket. But unless that 70% of people will do the opposite and say, hey, if you do commit to net zero emissions, I won't shop at you, then the minority win. The 30% who make the decision based on that issue beat the 70% who don't care either way. They don't care either way. And I think something similar could play out here with vaccine passports, that there is going to be a passionate minority, probably perhaps only 10 or 15% of people, a passionate minority will say, look, I'm just against showing my medical papers. Vaccinated or no vaccinated, I'm against showing my medical papers. So if you require that, I'm going somewhere else. And the other 85% of people, let's say, are they going to only go to cafes that require vaccines? Some will. But will enough of them do that to outweigh the minority? I'm not so sure. I don't know. And I think at least what I see in the United States at the moment, where there is much less government-controlled rollout of passports, you're not really seeing the market produce that. I mean, so you've got some states like New York or cities like New York who are mandating it. But in an environment where just it's up to the market, which I think is what will prevail here in Australia, if it's up to the market, you're not really seeing a mad rush from businesses to require vaccinations, at least in those in competitive environments like supermarkets or coffee shops, etc., restaurants. So that's, you know, I think that's something to look for. That's something to work on, at least. It's my best response, and I know a lot of people are contacting me concerned about vaccine passports. You know, my honest opinion is the consumer boycott is going to work more or work better than us down here, unfortunately, organising it for you. That's just the reality of it. That's just the reality. But I'll probably talk more about that in coming weeks. It is a major change in our society, and we can see it coming down the tracks. Speaking of silly decisions from governments, the Queensland government this week. Queensland government again this week continued their COVID pantomime of announcements on issues that they just lob onto the national stage. There's not really a process in Queensland, is there? They don't really go through. You do wonder, do they have a cabinet in Queensland? Do these decisions go through such a process It seems to be a government run by just media release, and I'll show that in a second. They don't really seem to go through a considered decision-making process, and the decision this week to build a quarantine camp in Toowoomba lacks all kind of process. I put out this tweet the other night, which I'll explain to you in the afternoon, actually, as I see there. I thought it was in the evening, but it was in the afternoon. And I mean, it's my thesis here that this was a controlled media initiative from the Queensland government this week. I'll take you through it, but I reckon my tweet said that the Queensland government manufactured a hotel shortage this week so they could announce a quarantine camp in a regional area that doesn't have the health systems to support it. It's a bait and switch. The Queensland government conducted a bait and switch on us all, in my view. I think on balance, the evidence seems to show. I don't know this for sure. I don't have any inside intel or some such, but I watched and saw what they were doing this week, and it had all the hallmarks of that. It just seemed to be such a transparent bait and switch policy. This was the front page of the Courier Mail on Wednesday, I think, yes, Wednesday of this week. Wednesday, the 25th of August, there you can see. And the front page from the Premier, no room at the inn. Hotel quarantine packed. So I woke up on Wednesday and saw that we had no earlier warning of this. We'd never heard of this issue before. But that we woke up and heard that Queensland hotel quarantine system was under extraordinary pressure, with 5,000 people in quarantine, and a steady rise occurring. They had to have an issue. There was a big issue. There's a little bit more than 5,000 hotel rooms in Queensland, just a little bit more. There's a lots on the Gold Coast and Cairns that are completely empty at the moment because of the border closures. It's kept out all the tourists. But even in Brisbane, there's plenty. You go on hotels.com or wherever you want, there's plenty of hotels available. There's no shortage of hotels. So I was a little sceptical when I saw this story. It just seemed something that the Queensland government had got out to the Courier Mail just to get a front page. And then, so within, that was published on the front page. So it was published overnight, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. Within a couple of hours of that, or a few hours of that, by 10:30, that morning, the Queensland government announced a pause on interstate hotspot arrivals. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, well, definitely that story, this front page was planted, clearly. It was planted to then help justify the media release came later in the day. I don't think the Queensland government woke up, saw the front page, and went, oh, we better pause. No, I'm sure this decision had been made through whatever process the Queensland government has. This decision had been made before that front page. And the media release, just to be clear, so the media release was pretty light on, wasn't much to it. This is a major thing. They were saying keeping all Queenslanders from coming home. It was a huge decision. And it was announced with only a few hours warning. So I think my understanding was, and I might be wrong here, but my understanding was this was announced at 10:24 a.m. on the Wednesday morning. And then I think anybody after 12 a.m. arriving after 12 a.m. Was potentially not going to be denied access to Queensland. So only a couple of hours notice to people, and I'll come back to that. But in this media release, the Premier said that our hotels are full, and this is about keeping Queenslanders safe. Queensland is being loved to death, according to the Premier. We have been overwhelmed by new arrivals from interstate hotspots, relocating to Queensland to escape lockdowns in New South Wales and Victoria. While we have allowed genuine relocations for work and other purposes, it has overwhelmed our hotels and has to be stopped, at least for the next fortnight. Her health minister went on to say that the pressures on hotel quarantine are simply unsustainable. We never know how many domestic arrivals we have, etc., etc. You know the one thing that's not in that media release? There's no why. What? Why? Why is it unsustainable? Why are we being loved to death? There's no actual clear reason. What are the constraints in the hospital system? There's clearly no lack of hotels. There's plenty of hotels in Brisbane, plenty of hotels on the Gold Coast, plenty of hotels in Cairns. We could accommodate a lot more people. Now, some people have speculated that it's not the hotels, it's the police or the security, the buses, all the arrangements that have to be put in place to manage these issues. But that's not in the media release. It's not mentioned at all. That would be a pretty simple thing to mention, but it's not there. And it's not clear how some of those issues would be dealt with in 2 weeks anyway. If it's not enough police, well, they're not going to be able to employ more police within 2 weeks. How's that going to work? Perhaps they just didn't need to need some time for commercial negotiations with hotels. But again, that's not mentioned. Given how serious this decision is, you'd expect to see some kind of detail from the Queensland government. But no. It's all just a media story. It didn't go well, though. Didn't go that well. Within a few hours, or this might have been the next day, was it? No, same day. Within a few hours, anger grows as relocations to Queensland paused. And there's a poll there. Look, the poll's against the hotel quarantine, at least the online poll. Probably doesn't mean much. But what I was interested here, and I'll try and find, I think it was Grant. Yes, here, Grant. Let's just see, this is what really angers me about some of the decisions that are made during COVID. There's almost an inhumane disregard for people. Notionally, these state governments are making these decisions to save people's lives. But they make a decision like this, and there's almost no regard for how it will impact people who have been just had their lives overturned in the space of a couple of hours. So I just wanted to read you a little bit from Grant, and I'll just try and move that over a bit so you can see the text. I might need to go back a bit smaller. So Grant here, he applied for a border permit 2 weeks ago. So he was approved to come in 2 weeks ago. He's taken his kids out of school in Melbourne. Those kids have gone out of school. And they were due to start in Queensland on Monday, so I presume this is being taped on a Friday, so it's the Monday after the weekend. His lease on his house ended today, the day that I'm taping this on Friday. His flights are booked for tomorrow, so that would have been Thursday, I think, when he was writing this. The removalists have already taken all his goods. His pets are on the road. To Queensland. They're going to a kennel at least when they get there. And they've got 14 days, I suppose, in that kennel. While his family, presumably, are scheduled to do their quarantine. All that ended. So he's got no home as of tonight. He'd have no home. His arrangements for his pets have been thrown into disarray. And his kids have no school. Thank you. Thank you, Anastasia Palaszczuk. Well done. That's a fellow Australian. He might be a Victorian, I don't care. He is an Australian citizen that the Premier of Queensland just made homeless. So next time you hear Labor governments complaining about the rate of homelessness and the lack of money they're getting from the federal government, just remind them they just created people being put out of a home with a heartless decision that had no consideration for them. But it gets worse because the next day, the Premier announced that she was going to build a quarantine facility in Toowoomba. Now, I'm really cynical. I've been in politics for 10 years and maybe it's made me a little bit too cynical, but I just am a little bit cynical. Isn't it just a little bit convenient here that we went from front page, no room at the inn, we better pause hotels, we better pause the hotel arrivals. Next day, we've got the solution. We're going to build a quarantine camp. That's a little. So, there is only a couple of possibilities here. One is that after identifying this surge that they announced on the Wednesday, within 24 hours, because the announcement of the, get this, have a look at this. The pause on interstate hotspot arrivals, 10:24 on the 25th of August. The decision to build a new quarantine facility, 10:36 the next day. So within 24 hours, they'd identified the problem, a quarantine system that was over capacity, And 24 hours later, 24 hours, 10 minutes later, they'd come up with a solution. We'll build a camp. Yay. Well done. Well done, Queensland government. But I'm a bit more cynical. I think the other option's more likely, that the Queensland government had this as a media plan the whole week. They'd planned it out. They'd planned it out. We'll announce that the hotel system's under pressure. We'll get a bit of anger. And then we'll distract people by announcing a quarantine facility. And the reason I think it was planned is within 24 hours, the Premier had organised a big piece of yellow kit to start moving dirt. I think that was just moving dirt. I don't think anything actually had been or was happening up there at that stage, but it's moving dirt. And they had a big photo op in Toowoomba at World Camp with the Wagners here, and good luck. Good luck to Dennis. Well, I think it was Dennis there. Oh, John, sorry. I think John Wagner, all the Wagners there. Good luck to them. Good luck to them. But the people of Toowoomba definitely didn't get a say. The council weren't informed of it. There was no consultation with Toowoomba Health Services about whether they can cope with a quarantine facility in their town. There was no consultation with the federal government who's responsible for quarantine arrivals. And this is going to be the biggest white elephant in our nation's history. It is going to be an absolute white elephant, all for the media program of the Queensland government for a few days. It is going to be a big waste of money, because I cannot see any international rivals going to this quarantine facility. To get that, you'd need the federal government approval, and they haven't got that. They haven't got that. And the reason they haven't got that is because there's not a tier 3 hospital there in Toowoomba. So any COVID cases picked up at this facility would then need to be transported from Toowoomba down to Brisbane. That's what in fairness, the Queensland government says that. They said that they will transport people. That's going to be a risk, though. That's going to be a risk because someone is going to have to transfer those coronavirus patients in a bus or an ambulance in an enclosed space for around 90 minutes. It's about a 90-minute drive from World Camp to Brisbane, depending on traffic and what have you. So that is a risk. That's a risk to that driver. The Queensland government's putting them in a risky position. Again, all for their own publicity machine. At the other end, there's no guarantee. That's guaranteed. That is definitely guaranteed. There's a guarantee that risk will happen. That because infected people, and you will get them, you do get them in quarantine, they will have to be transported by some other poor sap driver for 90 minutes, and that could put them at risk of an infection. And we all saw, how did the Sydney outbreak, can you remind me how the New South Wales outbreak occurred, the Sydney outbreak occurred? That's right. It was a limo driver transporting people from the Sydney airport to hotel quarantine. Now, that's a risk. Whatever quarantine facility you've got, that you're going to have that risk. Now, as it came out, that driver wasn't wearing a mask, and that's changed. Whether or not that would have made a difference, who knows. But there's a risk, right? There's a risk that through a quarantine arrangement, you're going to get an infection in the transport. But the risk is a hell of a lot much greater when you're transporting someone at 90 minutes from an airport to a quarantine facility 90 minutes away, compared to in the case of Sydney, where it would have been 20, 30 minutes from the Sydney airport into the presumably CBD to a hotel. That's a big difference. And again, the Palaszczuk government in their media release have not answered that at all. How will that be impacted? There was not a single mention of increased health services either for Toowoomba. They've just left high and dry Toowoomba by this announcement. I know, I used to live there. Not a lot of people like this. They don't want it. And yet they're just ignored by this government. But that's the Queensland government. There's the bait and switch. I don't know if it'll work. Make sure you tell other people if you don't want it to work. Sometimes they get away with too much, the Queensland government, but that's a lesson in media management for this week. Look, I just want to finish on the COVID theme today too. I gave a speech this week in the Senate. We've got a new innovation in the Senate, 2-minute statements. So that it's not very long, the speech is not long to watch. It's gone pretty well. I definitely think we do need to end the lockdowns, as I said at the start. I really worry about the restrictions coming on our place. As I said in this speech, I don't think we want to be a penal colony again. I think we want our freedoms back. The suffering that people are going through is inequitable, selfish, and cruel, and should be stopped. So if you do support that, try and share this. Share this with people, because it seems to have had a good reaction. It's got up to around 6,000 likes on Facebook, over 1,000 there likes and 500 shares on Twitter. So go to my Twitter feed or Facebook. It's up there. Get it around and share it to people. You can, of course, also follow me at those websites. The links or information are sitting there below. Thanks for listening to this just review of the week podcast. I might try and do a bit more of them while I'm in lockdown. I hope you're doing okay, whatever you're up to, and God bless.